Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. War fatigue and the blame game has begun. Well, it's not looking good for Ukraine. Outsized propaganda is completely at odds with the military reality on the ground. Add to this the unintended consequences sanctions have had on Western economies. Who, if anyone, will be held accountable? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Glenn Diesen in Oslo. He is a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway, as well as author of the book, Russophobia, Propaganda in International Politics. And in Budapest, we have George Samueli. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Glenn here. Glenn, let me read you a few headlines that won't surprise you or George or our viewers, considering our coverage of what's going on in Ukraine over the last few months. Ukraine's at risk of losing war with Russia, military official. That's from Newsweek. A shortage of artillery ammunition saps Ukrainian frontline morale. That's New York Times. We're almost out of ammunition and relying on Western arms, says Ukraine. That's The Guardian. Ukraine is running out of ammunition as prospects dim on the battlefield, Washington Post. I could go on and on. But my point in mentioning this, Glenn, is that the narrative is changing, the coverage is changing, but not the policy. So how do you square that?
Well, that's a good question. I guess because the media has been selling this as a Ukrainian victory for so long, and I agree, this is very false. I think it's been obvious at least since April that this war for Donbass at least is over. So they've been selling this for so long now. At some point, reality will catch up. You can't ignore it anymore now that all the supply lines are being cut off and you see this huge disparity. But I just have to add very quickly, this has been the case for most of the war. This is a war primarily now with artillery. And when Russia has about 20 times more artillery, then they will win every battle pretty much. And this is why it's been slowly breaking down the Ukrainian defenses, but they have been winning. Now, obviously, now is a breaking point. You see a lot of this defensive lines of the Ukrainians have been broken through. And also, this is a very critical point because Severodonetsk is now almost fallen. Russia's already reached Bakhmut. And lastly, you have Slavyansk. Now that the Russia crossed the Severodonetsk River, they're preparing now the siege for Slavyansk. With the end of these three cities, that's it. This is the fight for Donbass is over. So I think, but if you told if you've been telling the people through the media that the Ukraine was winning all along, at some point you have to flip it back. And I think that's, I think that's what's happening now. There is this need to recognize that, oops, something has happened. So this is obvious when you want to flip it and say, oh, well, actually, Ukraine is not winning anymore, it's losing, then you have to explain what happened. And that's why I think it's going to be very interesting in the media now, because nobody wants to be blamed for this. The Ukrainians don't want to be blamed. The Americans don't want to be blamed. NATO doesn't want to be blamed. So we're looking at a big discussion for, who lost Ukraine, I think.
We're going to get to the blame game here. Let me go to George here. My question to Glenn was very unfair because I'm asking him essentially to explain the rationale of the people making decisions. And you can't explain it, okay? It has been absolutely without foundation, logical foundation, the decision-making process here from the get-go and even going back to December. So, George, I mean, it's quite gratifying. I mean, what we've been saying for so long is being said in mainstream media. But that doesn't seem to impact policy. More arms, more arms, more money. I mean, how long can that continue without, pitchforks coming out? Go ahead.
Well, that's a very good question. And it is no question that the media are essentially preparing the groundwork for the inevitable blame game. Note what's really going on here. They are shifting the blame onto Ukraine. Into this, it's going to be Zelensky, and the fact is that it shouldn't be Zelensky. It should be the West that has to bear responsibility, because in late March in Istanbul, there appeared to be an agreement on the table. I mean, we were very close then to an agreement. In other words, how many people's lives could have been saved if an agreement had been signed in late March? But it was the West that came in. It was the West that told Zelensky, don't sign. As Johnson said, Putin is just a crocodile. You can't negotiate with a crocodile. And from that moment on, just there'd be no negotiations, no agreement on anything. So now they're trying to shift, it's all Zelensky's fault. But it really isn't. And so this is a very familiar refrain in the United States, but I mean Vietnam as well. We're winning until we're not winning. And then whose fault is that? That's the fault of the South Vietnamese. It's the terrible regimes, the corruption, the generals, whatever. We did our best. We gave them everything we got. They just couldn't win the war. It was the same in Iraq. It's the same with Afghanistan. Oh, it's all Ghani. It's all the corruption. It's these terrible warlords. We did what we could. We're the good guys. So the media are essentially laying the groundwork for the self-justifications. And unfortunately, the media will probably let them get away with it.
Well, yeah. And also, go back to Glenn here. This is a political football, particularly in the United States with elections coming up. Because I think it's a fair characterization. This has been a Democratic Party driven war, even though your usual fleckless Republicans that are neocons were going along with it. But I mean, the media is smelling blood in the water here, because no one wants to take responsibility for this catastrophe. And let's be very clear, a catastrophe for the Ukrainian people. Okay, I think that we need to point that out more often in this program. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, I agree. Also, on the last point, this is a horrific, horrific situation for the Ukrainians. There should have been a solution to this even well before the war began. So this is, of course, they're terrible. But I think the reason why they kept pumping in, well, obviously, saying that they're winning is necessary, because when you fight a war, you need the public on your side. So you need two components. You have to say your opponent did something awful, but we're bringing justice. So we are succeeding. They're being defeated. But once this narrative shifts and you notice that it's not happening anymore, that you're losing the war, then the people withdraw their support. But of course, so you want to delay this for as long as possible. But I think they knew for a long time that they were losing. But often the one has to then visit the objective of this. So like, why have they been pumping so many weapons in? Because surely one can make a moral argument, you should give weapons everyone to give them the right to defend themselves, for example. However, in the United States, they've been very open about other objectives as well. I'm thinking like politicians like Dan Crenshaw, who very openly came out and said, well, listen, we should send weapons. It's a good way of killing Russians and weakening one of our main adversaries. And we put none of our own lives on the line. So in other words, which is often been repeated by many other advocates of pumping in weapons, which is, let's fight this to the last Ukrainian, because the result will be, yes, of course, the Ukrainians will pay a heavy price, but the Russians will be severely weakened as well. And this is a bonus, and we don't have to pay with any American lives. So given that this has been an objective, I think you've had this incentive for a long time to prolong the war. But obviously, so that's a benefit of prolonging the war, to weaken Russia. However, it comes now with a cost, which is if the Ukrainian army collapses now, the cost is they will lose a lot of territory. And this is the territory the Americans wanted, primarily the Black Sea coast. That's why they've had so much interest over the last 20 years. So now suddenly you need to switch it quickly and, put the engine in place for moving towards some kind of a diplomatic solution. And of course, this is a wonderful news. It's just very, very hypocritical. That's my point.
Yeah, but George, I mean, the horse has bolted the barn. I mean, why would Russia be interested in negotiations now? Okay, I mean, because this is good. Call it Cold War 2.0, the Cold Shoulder War, whatever you want to call it. We're not going back. I mean, the Russians have no incentive and have no reason to believe any guarantees coming from the West.
No, they really don't, and that's why. It's so reckless and irresponsible not to have taken the deal in late March, because at that moment, at least some kind of a rump Ukrainian state would have survived. It's not at all clear to me that any kind of a Ukraine will survive after this war, because the Russians are now going to exact a much heavier price than they were ready to settle for in Istanbul. And I don't know that there'll be any kind of a Ukraine left. I mean, they'll, you know, the Black Sea coast will be lost. I think it may well be that the Poland is going to move into Galicia. All kinds of bits and pieces of Ukraine will just secede. You know, they might be just form separate entities of their own, or they might join with Novorossiya. So it's not at all clear that there'll be anything left. And that's why it's been so irresponsible to keep pressing on for this. And as Glenn said, the objective was just, okay, well, let's just inflict as much casualties on Russia as possible. You know, with the only proviso is we don't get into a shooting war with Russia. You know, we'll send whatever we can, kill as many as we can, but we'll just maintain this plausible deniability that we're just simply giving them the means to defend themselves. We ourselves are not involved in this. And they'll say, okay, well, we're okay. We haven't suffered any casualties. It's their tough luck.
Yeah, but Glenn, I mean, there's a kind of a double whammy, as it were, here. Not only does Ukraine lose and lose very badly, and I would entertain some of the things that George is saying, what the future of Ukraine, whatever Ukraine will be, is, I think, in question right now. But the Western objective was to devastate the Russian economy and isolate Russia. Neither one has happened. So it's kind of turning into a double defeat. Glenn.
No, definitely. And I, because for the United States, they've had many, first, this looks like it would be a very good war, because it would achieve many things. For one, this idea that, Ukraine could never become another Poland, like a very anti-Russian country. Well, obviously now, I think anti-Russian sentiment will dominate for a long time, for decades probably, in the Ukrainian national identity, at least more so in the western parts, but also throughout the country. So this has been an objective, to split Russia and Ukraine for forever. But also this economic ties, because the United States has been very worried over the past, many years now, about the economic ties between the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese. And they've been frustrated that their security guarantees haven't been converted into this economic loyalty. But now it has. Europeans have cut themselves off of Russia. They're also now trying to extend this to China. And again, all of Europe's economic interests have been linked up to Washington. So all the strategic autonomy, this is canceled effectively. This is dependent.
The interesting thing here is that we keep hearing the mantra of, you know, Ukraine's sovereignty. But George, if I go to you, I mean, it's the end of European sovereignty.
Yes, it is the end of the sovereignty. And so all of the dreams that the EU entertained since, say, 1992.
All right, let's end on dreams here, gentlemen. We have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team.
Это были мирные жители. На местах их дислокации были обнаружены массовые захоронения мирных жителей, даже беременных женщин.
Он однажды меня спросил: «Мама, как ты относишься к этим событиям, которые произошли в Одессе?»
Более 25 тысяч гражданских объектов разрушено. Более 2000 стариков, женщин, детей убиты.
Непонятно, по каких причинам украинский народ просто уничтожает сам себя.
Никогда, никогда после этого всего мириться или возвращаться в Украину никогда.
Нас называли дивизией Waffen-СС. Я узница концлагеря Салспиля, страшного Салспиля. Заживо гнили дети.
Это не доказано, то есть научно.
Там на полметра была пропитана земля полусгоревшим человеческим жиром. 632 тела ребенка.
Здесь мой звон. Очень интеллигентные люди. Очень приятно было работать.
Больно это все вспоминать.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Georgia and Budapest. Well, we were running out of time in the first block here. Finish your point. We're talking about European sovereignty moving forward.
Yes, so all the dreams that were entertained since 1992, that Europe will become a kind of an alternative model of the West. So there'll be essentially two power blocks in the West. There'll be the United States with this kind of, you know, ur-capitalism, and then there'll be the kind of social democratic form of capitalism in Europe. And this Europe will be kind of the mediating force between the United States and Russia. China wasn't such an important player in 1992. That's gone. That Europe that's going to be an alternative model of the West, that's simply gone. And then, you know, Europe has now severed its ties from Russia and has become dependent on the United States, particularly when it comes to energy, because it's going to it's cut itself off from energy imports from Russia, which means dependent on the United States and then dependent on the Middle East. So essentially, Europe has gone backwards when it comes to that. And so, the Americans have got what they wanted. I mean, this is something that we go back to again, 1991, 92, when Paul Wolfowitz wrote his famous memorandum for George H.W. Bush, which was that, you know, we need to prevent any other power dominating any other continent. You know, the United States has to dominate every single continent, and therefore that nightmare that there would be a kind of a Eurasia that will be free of American dominance, that nightmare, you know, the Americans have put to rest for a long time.
Yeah, well, what's good for Washington is now, by definition, bad for Europe. Let's talk about Europe here. According to the Institute for New Social Answers, and published in the German publication Bild, one in six Germans skipping meals to save money. Also, Poles, it's been reported, they've changed the law in Poland, allowing Poles to forage for wood in forests to keep their houses warm. And there's also reports, it's not in en masse yet, but municipalities in France are giving out food coupons because people don't have enough money to buy food. I mean, this was supposed to happen to Russia. It wasn't supposed to happen to Europe. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, exactly. And again, that was the prediction. Within a week or so, the Russian economy would collapse, its financial system would collapse, and its currency would collapse. Instead, we see the economy, soon going back to growth once the supply chains have been reorganized, the financial system is stabilized, and the currency is getting a bit too strong. I think it was down to 57 rubles a dollar now. Before the war, it was about 72, 74. So it is much stronger than it was before. So Russia has sailed out of this quite well, while the Europeans now are struggling a lot. I mean, here it's the currency not doing well, the financial system and the economy is becoming more and more broken. And I think part of this goes back to this propaganda we had for many years, because you know, it's always an incentive to exaggerate the weakness or the strength of an adversary. Often we do both with Russia, either this overwhelming threat that controls every election, referendum, and, you know, finger in everything, or it's this ridiculous country who can't even make a radiator. It's just, they're so backwards. And so I think we bought into this Russian weakness that they're pretending the Russian economy is the size of, you know, Spain or something. We failed to recognize that often in when we talk about economic interdependence, there's some economic variables as well in which creates more dependencies. So, for example, you know, then the natural resources are a key one, the key metals. I mean, all of these things, the food, I mean, in many ways, but also in the high tech within digital giants and all. You see, Russia is very much a very self-sufficient country. And what we're discovering in Europe now is we have been very dependent on Russia. And even if we're successful at, you know, stop buying Russian gas, for example, and we can buy more expensive gas other places, it's not going to happen. But even if we were successful, this would mean our industries would no longer be competitive because Russia's selling a lot of these resources now on a discount to the East simply because they very quickly have to reorganize its trading patterns. So this has huge consequences. Not only is Russia very self-sufficient, but we also discovered that the rest of the world did not really join in on sanctions. You have NATO and a few of America's allies in the East, so Japan and South Korea. But this is the problem. We're kind of waking up, still believing it's the 90s. We're realizing now, oh, this is a very different world.
Yeah, it's very interesting, George, that with selling discounted Russian oil and gas to the global South has the knock-on effect of making those countries more, increases their productivity as productivity in Europe decreases because they have higher energy costs. I mean, didn't anybody kind of think this through? I already know the answer to that. George, what are the consequences here? I mean, elections have consequences, and I cannot see how any ruling government in continental Europe is going to fare very well. I mean, you can put a Ukrainian flag on your lapel just for so long when you're standing in line to buy food.
George? Yes, that's right. And really, when you think of Europe, and Europe was always very vulnerable on the issue of competitiveness. So because it was always, they had these, a social market economy, very expensive labor, plus, the high welfare payments. It was always questionable whether they'd be able to compete in the long term against the Asian giants. But now that they've shot themselves in the foot with energy, it's very hard to see how they can compete. And moreover, now they're stuck with these sanctions because, whatever the outcome is going to be here in Ukraine, they aren't going to end the sanctions. And they, they're still, talking up the sanctions. Ursula von der Leyen, she was in Kiev, I think it was yesterday, on Saturday. And again, still talking about sanctions and about, Ukraine winning. So they're now stuck with this. They're stuck with this breach with Russia. And it's hard to see how they could get around it. I mean, the United States, very happy, good. We've got rid of our economic rival. Asia, obviously happy. But for Europe, I mean, I think that it really doesn't look good. And we can see it politically. I mean, Boris Johnson is in a lot of trouble, and it's only only part of it is because of the his party's in Downing Street. But I think that's not the most important thing. I mean, people are seeing what the cost of living and the dire prospects for this coming winter. This is affecting Johnson. He's obviously going to fall. We have other countries. We have Scholz, extremely unpopular. This is going to continue throughout Europe.
So, Glenn, explain it to us here. Russia was sanctioned for its military operation in Ukraine, and then it will be sanctioned when Ukraine is defeated in that operation. So, it's for the foreseeable future, Russia will be sanctioned by the West. I mean, there's no timeline on that now. Go ahead.
Well, I know there's no timeline, but I think they want to get off these sanctions soon because if Russia,
would that be rewarding Russia? See how you go into their mindset?
Yes, of course. One can't reward Russia, even though the sanctions hurt us more. But again, at some point, they are realizing that Russia's making more money of its energy now than ever before, and our economies are becoming uncompetitive because of this higher fuel costs. But that being said, I think that's why it's so important to shift blame to someone, because when Russia's being rewarded, who's to blame? And I think we see all these different parties starting to blame each other. And you mentioned before this debate on who lost Ukraine. I mean, look at the media now. New York Times only a few days ago argued that they have no overview of the Ukraine military. They know more about the Russian military than the Ukrainian. Obviously, this is not true, but But the whole point is that this is the Ukrainians' fault. They didn't share intelligence. That's where they're going. And also you see other ways. So, for example, you see Biden administration giving a little bit of powerful weapons to Ukraine, because if they give too much and it's used to attack Russian territory, Russia will strike back. And it has reserves the right to then attack training camps being in Poland or Germany. So they don't want to give too heavy weapons to drag America into it. However, the fact that they're giving like four drones or a couple of those HIMARS, the point is that it looks like they're preempting a future argument, saying, listen, we gave them everything. We gave them most powerful weapons. It's the Ukrainians' fault. So I think this is why it's important to have someone to blame, because once you start rewarding Russia as it is by removing the sanctions, someone has to shift the blame. Just on a very quick note, you also see Ukraine doing a little bit of the same now, because they've gone out and said that they've been losing, that they're losing now hundreds of people a day. So 200 dead, like 500 wounded. So essentially a battalion knocked out every day, which is horrific, by the way. But they're saying, and then adding, saying this is always sacrificed, but the West is not giving us the weapon we need. So this is quite interesting. So they're also kind of, the political authorities there is also kind of arguing now that we did everything we could. It's our partner's fault. So if we have to make peace somehow with Russia, it looks like we're turning on each other instead to see who to blame. And again, there's a lot of blame to go around. So, you know, this also now looking into think tanks and all. And I'm not sure if you noticed or people noticed that most of our sources, newspapers, they tend to go to this Institute for the Study of War. You know, sounds very super academic, but it's actually a think tank, very ideological think tank. And now they're the one who've been informing us about the war, so we might start scrutinizing them because our intelligence is obviously incorrect. So,
George hit the nail on the head earlier. I mean, it's never the decision makers' fault. It's always somebody else. You know, it's bad intel, bad actors. We shouldn't have trusted them. But you know, George, I mean, there's one issue. And you and I talk a lot on our podcast, The Gaggle. Is that there's so much money involved in this here. I mean, that's one reason to keep it going, to keep for arms manufacturers, you know, and then these, you know, revenue transfers, you know, pallets, remember always pallets of money, you know, and then that goes somewhere we don't really know, and they don't seem to really particularly care, do they, George?
No, that's right. I mean, it's huge amounts of money. I mean, we talked a lot about that $40 billion package that Congress kind of signed off on, you know, in about 2 hours. But that's on top of all of the other money that has already been pouring into Ukraine. We're talking about, you know, maybe already this year, $80 billion just from the United States alone. And then we think of the UK and Canada and everyone else. So that's an awful lot of money that no one has any idea where it's gone. So yeah, this money is clearly being, it's a money laundering operation. Some people are making, are making a very nice living out of this. And again, you know, there's the interested parties. These think tanks, who funds these think tanks? They're funded by military contractors. I mean, that's all these Institute for the Study of War, which is run by, it's a neoconservative think tank. It's the Kagans. So, the Kagans who were instrumental, of course, in the Iraq war caper, but they're...
I look at it, I call it the kind of quasi-Afghan dividend here, okay, because it's replacing the Afghan grip. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Oslo and in Budapest, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RTC. And next time, remember, cross that voice.